And Dave, these are recorded, and if you ever miss, you can always either get the CD or get it online. So, okay, Psalm 140, after plowing through Psalm 139 or 119 for a number of weeks, and then getting to Psalm 139, which is one of the real highlights of the book of Psalms. Now we are in the final push to the end of the book, 140 to 150. Psalm 140 has a superscription up above it. It says, to the choir master, so as all of the Psalms, it was to be sung and played at the temple, a Psalm of David. Now in Psalm 140, David prays for deliverance from the plots of his enemies. And these trials that he was going through, as trials do for God's people, drove him closer to God. And that is certainly seen in this psalm. Our outline is by Peter Stevenson. And when we finish Psalms, I'll have in the notes a bibliography, which will have the names of all these books, such as this commentary by Peter Stevenson. So we have, first of all, David's prayer for deliverance, and that's found in verses 1, 2, and 3. And good to have Bonnie back. And jet lag and all, are you under jet lag? Okay. It wasn't put out, so I don't have it. So, okay, so Psalm 140, verse 1, David's prayer for deliverance. He begins the prayer saying, deliver me, O Lord, from evil men. Deliver in the sense of rescue. He's praying that God would rescue him from these evil men. The idea of evil men is people who harm the innocent and prey upon the ungodly, prey upon the godly. Now, probably David has in mind Saul and Saul's army that has been attacking him. But his prayer is, deliver me or rescue me from these men, O God, and preserve me from violent men. So preserve him until he rescues him. So ultimately, he's praying for rescuing, but until then, that God would preserve him, keep him from these violent men. Unfortunately, evil men, and of course, we are evil because of our heart that is sinful. Evil men develop into violent men. And we cannot expect to pass through this world without people desiring to do us harm. But we have a Heavenly Father who takes care of us, even in the midst of their rage. And of course, when I say we can't expect to go through this life without people wanting to harm us, there's the sense of the believer and the opposition to believers, but not even with that. I mean, just in the society that we live, there are violent people out there that want to harm us, everything from terrorists to people taking drugs or whatever. So that is out there. And David in his day had it. And so he prayed. Verse 2, concerning these evil, violent men who plan evil things in their heart. And the heart is the source of the problem. And in Jeremiah 17:9, it says the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Jeremiah 17:9. So these wicked, violent people plan evil things in their heart, and they stir up wars continually. They're kind of like a standing army that doesn't go on leave. It never lets down its guard. And they're surrounding David. And we can feel like it's surrounding us at times as well. Verse 3, they make their tongue as sharp as a serpent's. Now, it was a common belief in ancient times that snakes inserted their venom by their tongues. Because, you know, you see a snake and it's putting its tongue out, in and out all kinds of times, and then by that it's sensing heat and so on. It's kind of a sense of smell, that kind of thing. And in the ancient days, they had that picture that the venom was passed through the tongue. Of course, we know it through the fangs. And even in David's day, I'm sure they realized that it was fangs, but it became a poetic way of speaking. Even Shakespeare in King Lear has a little piece in there talking about the venom coming from the serpent's tongue. So these evil people make their tongue sharp as a serpent's, and under their lips is a venom of asp. And asp, of course, are a type of snake. Paul uses this phrase from verse 3 as part of his argument that we are all sinners in Romans chapter 3, verse 13. Romans 3 has that section indicting the whole human race for sin. And it will just, and it has all these quotations from the Old Testament. And this is one of them, pointing out our sinful nature. And so David is crying out to God because we would say today there's a hate campaign out against him. All this hate speech, the venom in the speech being poured out against him. When we were coming tonight, just a few minutes ago, Terry had an interesting question. If you could ask President Obama, what is the thing that has surprised you the most about being president, I wonder what he would answer. And my answer to Terry is, what I thought he would answer was he probably didn't expect all the hatred, didn't expect that everything would be opposed so strongly. And that's like David felt, and probably a whole lot more in his case. But then we have number 2. Oh, by the way, after verse 3, we have a statement, Selah, S-E-L-A-H. We haven't seen that in quite a few Psalms, but it is a musical term in the Psalms. We're not absolutely sure what it means. It is a musical term, probably has something to do with to pause in the music. And since we don't have the music, this is something that we're thinking about and going through and learning. You could say it would be the idea of pause and think about that. And this psalm is going to have 3 of them. Then in verse 4, we have number 2, David's prayer for preservation. Verse 4. Guard me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked. Preserve me from the violent men who have planned to trip up my feet. So he's continuing with this concern about the enemies that are against him. And he's asking God to guard him from the hands of the wicked. When you stop and think about it, no wild animal is as terrible to people as some people can be to other people. I mean, that's just part of the wickedness of the human heart. So no wonder David knew, knowing the cruelty that's out there, particularly in warfare in those days, and against himself as the king, if they could get their hands on him. So he cries out to God, guard me from the hands of the wicked. Preserve me from the violent men. And of course, even for us. In our day, we can be in our homes just minding our own business and violence can strike. We could be pumping gas at the gas pump and a random shooter come by. I mean, we all know it's a dangerous world out there because of people being violent. So this is part of our prayer to the Lord as well. Preserve me from violent men who have planned to trip up my feet. Verse 5, the arrogant have hidden a trap for me, and with cords they have spread a net. Beside the way they have set snares for me. They're sneaky, they're crafty, but the beautiful thing about what David is doing in bringing this to the Lord is David knows none of this takes God by surprise. There's nothing, that no trap that they can lay out there that is going to take God by surprise. So therefore, since he knows where the traps are, he can protect us. He can direct our step around it, if that's his will. And we are in good hands with the Lord. Number three, David's prayer for protection. Verse 6, I say to the Lord, you are my God. Give ear to the voice of my pleas for mercy, O Lord. Now, he cries out to God, and he's able to call him my God, which is one of the beautiful things about the Psalms, is to see that personal relationship that the psalmist had and that we have in crying out to him. Give ear to the voice of my pleas for mercy, O Lord. Verse 7, O Lord, my Lord, the strength of my salvation, you have covered my head in the day of battle. Now he's calling him the strength of his salvation. That is salvation in the sense of deliverance from his enemies. We're used to salvation in the New Testament, being something, of course, involved with saving us from sin. And that is in the Old Testament, but many times, such as in this case, salvation isn't referring to sin, but is referring to deliverance from enemies. And so he says, behind this deliverance from my enemies that you're going to give me is the fact that it is the Lord who is the strength. He is the power behind his protection. David learned it at a young age. Remember when he goes up against Goliath and he tells Saul the experience that as a youth watching his father's flocks, that the bear came and the lion came and so on. And he says, it was the Lord who gave me the strength to defeat them. And then he saw that happen with Goliath. So David had a lot of personal background on this idea of the strength being God's strength in his deliverance. But it's an interesting terminology that he then uses here. You have covered my head in the day of battle. And of course, a head wound was most often fatal, and so they would wear a helmet or some kind of protection. And in Ephesians 6, in the armor, that spiritual armor that we are given, we are told about a helmet, the helmet of salvation, because when they went into battle, they would wear a physical helmet. And when David looked back over his past dangers and the past deliverances, he knew that he would have been killed if it were not for God's hand upon him. And so he pictures that as if God had covered his head, is his poetic way of describing the fact that God has protected him. Goliath and Saul had their bodyguards and the soldiers around them protecting them, but David had the Lord. The Lord had covered his head. Verse 8, he says, grant not, O Lord, the desires of the wicked. Do not further their evil plot, or they will be exalted. David recognizes that his enemies can do no more than what God will allow them to do. You know, that is an important lesson from the book of Job concerning Satan. Even Satan himself could not do, just have free rein to do whatever he wanted to do against Job. God was the one who was saying, can't kill him. Early in the story, can't touch him. Then God says, okay, you can touch him. But God was the deciding voice on what would happen. And David understands something of that. And so he says, grant not, O Lord, the desires of the wicked. And if God would stop them, there's no way that they can accomplish those wicked desires. Do not further their evil plot, or they will be exalted. Then turning the page to number four, on page 335, David's prayer for victory. verses 9 to 11. As for the head of those who surround me, let the mischief of their lips overwhelm them. Now, while God protected David's head in the previous couple of verses, back in verse 7, David now asks that the head of his foes be unprotected. And so he says, God, I ask that you not protect their head, and that the mischief of their lips overwhelm them. In other words, God, that they would reap the consequences of what they've done, that the evil that they are doing to others would come back on them. And verse 10, he gives some examples of what he would like to see God do to them. Let burning coals fall upon them. Let them be cast into fire, into miry pits, no more to rise. It's interesting that with each one of these, we have examples in the Old Testament. For instance, burning coals. What do you think of with burning coals? Sodom and Gomorrah, the fire and brimstone. The God rained on those cities to destroy them. It's kind of the same idea here. He's saying, God, you did it to Sodom and Gomorrah. I pray that you would do it to these enemies. Let them be cast into the fire. May the consequences that they plan for others come upon them. I think an example would be of Nebuchadnezzar in the Old Testament, who planned with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I'm going to get them, I'm going to cast them into the fiery furnace. And the psalmist is saying, wouldn't it have been quite a scene if Nebuchadnezzar winds up being thrown into the same fire? Now, he wasn't. And he winds up repenting before God after coming under judgment of God and gives a testimony of belief in the true God. But say that had happened, that would have been the kind of thing that he's praying for here. And then into the miry pits no more to rise. In Genesis 14, there's an incident of the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, some years before Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, when there was a big war that involved Lot, and Abraham rescued Lot and so on. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and their soldiers got mired in these bitumen pits that were around the Dead Sea area and wound up dying in them. And that's the idea that David picks up here. Verse 11, let not the slanderer be established in the land. Let evil hunt down the violent man speedily. The evil person is hunting down the righteous person. So David is praying, let evil hunt down that person. Then we end the psalm in verses 12 and 13 with David's expression of confidence. Verse 12, I know that the Lord will maintain the cause of the afflicted and will execute justice for the needy. It's interesting cry and request that God would execute this justice for the needy. The needy cannot help themselves. And so he's praying that God would take care of them and meet their need and execute justice and take care of their enemies. We have the saying that is so American, that God helps those who help themselves. And there are so many people that believe that's in the Bible. It's not in the Bible, and it's not biblical. What is biblical is that God helps those who can't help themselves, such as the needy that are here. Verse 13, surely the righteous shall give thanks to your name. The upright shall dwell in your presence. And that's true for the believer, and it's true when it says dwell in your presence. It's true now that we dwell in his presence. We have fellowship with him. Hebrews says we can enter into the Holy of Holies and bring our requests and so on, and we have the access to him because of what he has done on the cross. But that's nothing compared to dwelling in his presence for eternity. So the upright shall dwell in your presence now and forever. So he ends the psalm on that great note. Turning the page, we then come to Psalm 141. And Psalm 141 also has a superscription, although a very short one, a Psalm of David. Nothing specific about the timing, just that David wrote it sometime in his life. Our outline is from the MacArthur Study Bible, and we have number one, Prayer for God's Haste. Verse 1, O Lord, I call upon you, hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. So he begins by calling out to the Lord and acknowledging the fact that he calls upon him. And that's a great reminder that prayer is talking with the Lord. It's coming into God's presence and talking to him. So many times, if we've been a Christian for many years, we just kind of take that for granted. But I put a quotation here from R.A. Torrey that I thought just kind of gives us kind of like a shot in the arm to not take that for granted. R.A. Torrey was a great noted Bible teacher at the turn of the 19th, 20th centuries. And he has a number of books still in print, and was very, very famous in his day and still highly respected. He was from Australia, went to Moody Bible Institute, became a dean of Moody Bible Institute, and then after Biola was founded, they were looking for a dean and they called him, and he was the one that really kind of put Biola on the map, was R.A. Torrey. But he wrote this, "We should never utter one syllable of prayer, either in public or in private, until we are definitely conscious that we have come into the presence of God and are actually praying to him. I was brought up to pray." And in the latest Biola Alumni Magazine, there's an article about R.A. Torrey's, I think it's his great-great-great-granddaughter, is a current student at Biola, the first of his descendants to go to Biola. And she talks in this article, she's interviewed, and she talks about visiting the home where R.A. Torrey grew up. It's still in the family. I think it's in New York. And she talked about being in this room upstairs where it was known that he prayed a lot. And she talked about how special that was to think about because he did give the impression of being a man who really knew what it was to pray. And he grew up in a Christian home, and he said, "I was brought up to pray. I was taught to pray so early in life that I have not the slightest recollection of who taught me to pray. Nevertheless, prayer was largely a matter of form. There was little real thought of God and no real approach to God. And even after I was converted, yes, even after I had entered the ministry, prayer was largely a matter of form. But the day came when I realized what real prayer meant, realized that prayer was having an audience with God, actually coming into the presence of God and asking and getting things from him. And the realization of that fact transformed my prayer life. Before that, prayer had been a mere duty, and sometimes a very irksome duty. But from that time on, prayer has been not merely a duty, but a privilege, one of the most highly esteemed privileges of life. Before that, the thought that I had was, how much time must I spend in prayer? The thought that now possesses me is, how much time may I spend in prayer without neglecting the other privileges and duties of life?" Good thought, good perspective. Well, David has that perspective, and he says, "O Lord, I call upon you, hasten to me." In other words, don't delay. There's an urgency that fills David's heart as he brings this prayer to God. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. So in other words, don't just let the words of prayer just kind of pass you by. But of course, God is not a body. It does not have a literal ear, but it's as if God would cup his hand to his ear and just get closer. Make sure that he hears every word is the picture that he's building here. Let my prayer be counted as incense before you. Now, David compares his praying to incense at the altar in the tabernacle, as the incense would be burned on the altar and the smoke would go up, and it was pictured as being a sweet smell to God. And of course, again, God doesn't have a body. He doesn't have a nose, literally, but it's the idea of that it's pleasing to God. And that has always, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, been a picture of prayer before God. Hearing his children is pleasing to God. Now, incense was presented every day in the tabernacle and later at the temple, usually together with the burnt offering at the altar and in connection with the evening sacrifice. I can get it a little warmer in here as people are putting their coats on. Well, you're not the only one. Okay. The thing is, David was not a priest, and only the priests could offer the incense. And so David, as he writes this, it's just interesting to see his perspective. He knows he can never go and literally offer incense on that altar. But he says, I can do something even better. I can pray. And my prayer will go up to God and be counted as incense before you. And the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. He cannot, as a priest, offer a sacrifice. He can bring an animal, but then turn it over to the priest, and only the priest can actually put it on and burn it and so on. But he says, I can lift up my hands. Lift up his hands was the symbol of his reaching out to God, humbling himself and crying out to God for help. And he said, I can do that. I cannot offer the actual sacrifice on the altar, cannot do the incense, but I can do this and come into your presence. Then number two, we have David's prayer for personal righteousness. He says in verse 3, set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. David recognizes that one of the evidences of his sinfulness is his mouth. Sound familiar? Remember Isaiah chapter 6, when he has the vision of the glory of God, and God wants him to go and be his spokesman. And Isaiah says, I can't. I am a man of unclean lips. And a seraph, one of the angels, goes to the altar where the coals are burning from the sacrifices and takes one of those coals and comes and puts it on his lips, symbolizing God's cleansing of his lips. That happens after David wrote this. So David didn't have that in mind, but it's an interesting connection between the two, because David is going to be dealing with his own sinfulness here. The spot of his body that he turns to first is his mouth. Then he says, keep watch over the door of my lips. Now, in David's case, he's in the midst of a lot of enemies. When there's a lot of enemies, a lot of pressure like that, it's easy for your lips to be coming out with anger, your lips to be coming out with retaliation, with all kinds of things like that. And he's saying, God, keep me from sinning with my lips, whether it be like that, or it could be with pride coming out of our lips, or all kinds of things like that. He says, his mouth, he wants to be pure in every conversation that he has. May it never be filled with lies. May it never be filled with pride. May it never be filled with words of anger. And it's to the point of, keep watch over the door of my lips. That is a good prayer for us. Verse 3 would be a good prayer for us to write out and have somewhere to see in our devotions periodically, to ask God to guard our lips, to set a door in front of our lips. Verse 4, do not let my heart incline to any evil. And by the way, we're turning the page here to all stay on the same page. 141 verse 4. There is an inseparable cause and effect relationship between the mouth and the heart. Luke chapter 6, verse 45. Luke 6, 45, Jesus said, out of the overflow of his heart, his mouth speaks. If the heart is corrupt, the lips are going to be corrupt. And so David goes deeper than the lips, and he turns to his heart. Do not let my heart incline to any evil, not even a little one. I had a bizarre phone conversation on Monday. I felt it was bizarre. I suppose from the world standpoint, it wasn't bizarre. A young woman called, and Kiara answered the phone, and she asked to speak to Pastor Uri, and Pastor Uri wasn't here, and so she asked to if there was any pastor she could speak to. So Kiara gave the call to me. Turns out she has spoken to Pastor Uri previously about issues in her life. But I was so taken aback by her first question, because her question was, and apparently the reason she called, was she was asking, is it okay to do a webcam? And I thought, a webcam? Well, there's nothing wrong with a webcam. And I was just kind of taken aback, and I said, well, no. But then all of a sudden, I thought, and I said, well, unless it's being used for pornography. But if it's just a family wants to be able to talk to their family on the East Coast, as such as we would with our son Steve and his family, well, there's nothing wrong with that. Well, it turns out it was pornography that she had in mind, that she was asking if it's okay if she would use a webcam to display her body. And I explained, no, that's okay. But her response was so interesting. Well, I have done things a lot worse than that, so I thought that would be okay. Well, we talked a little bit about why it wouldn't be okay. And of course, it's one of those times where after you get off the phone, you think of all the things that you wish you had said, and so on. But I thought of that this morning when I was looking at this. Do not let my heart incline to any evil, even those things that we think are not as bad as the other things that we've done. But the goal for the Christian is that we would be growing in holiness, not just trying to get a little bit better, but that there would be no inclination to evil. So that's his prayer, and it should be the prayer request of every believer. Do not let my heart incline to any evil, to busy myself with wicked deeds, in company with men who work iniquity, and let me not eat of their delicacies. He says, I want to be pure. I want to be clean. And I don't want to participate with them in the works of darkness, as Jesus would say in the New Testament. Verse 5, Now this gets kind of interesting, kind of a twist, a turn of events from what he's been saying. Let a righteous man strike me, it is a kindness. Let him rebuke me, it is oil for my head. Let my head not refuse it. What a striking statement. Let a righteous man strike me, it is a kindness. He's been talking about his wicked enemies and praying that the Lord would spare him from the things the wicked enemy would do. But he turns the corner and he says, now on the other hand, a righteous person, a righteous person, I'll accept it from a righteous person. Let him rebuke me. It is a kindness. This is the biblical concept of us as a believer sharpening our fellow believer. And when we see them doing something that's displeasing to God, seeing them in sin and so on, going to that brother or sister in love and bringing that to their attention. And it can hurt. It can be a rebuke. Now, it's to be done in the right attitude. But it can be a rebuke. But biblically, it's a kindness. It's a kindness to tell that person. David recognized that. And he said, it is oil for my head. That was something in that culture that was good. It was common hospitality when you went to someone's house for dinner. And you'd been traveling over the dusty road and so on, the servant would wash your feet. That always was done. And then sometimes they would come with a container of oil and pour it on your head. And you would just rub it in your hair and on your face, and you would just feel refreshed after being out in the dust and the hot sun. And David saw it that way. And he says the striking, and obviously this is not a physical hitting, but this is confronting him with words. It's a kindness, and it is oil for my head. And he asked God, let my head not refuse it. God, may I never be to the point where I don't listen when my brothers and sisters have words for me of correction, for things where I'm going in the wrong direction in my life. The last phrase then in verse 5, yet my prayer is continually against their evil deeds. He goes back to the present situation that he's in of the wicked and their plots against him. And about those people then he's talking about in the last phrase, my prayer is continually against their evil deeds. But he says when it comes to a righteous person, in effect, he's saying, bring it on. If it's justified, I need to hear it. Then in verse 6, we have number 3, David's prayer for justice. When their judges are thrown over the cliff. That's an interesting term. When their judges are thrown over the cliff. Now, this word, or this verse, is difficult in the Hebrew. And the translations kind of go all over the map. There you'll find real variation in the translations on this. But using the ESV, when their judges, now the judges would refer to the leaders. And in particular here, we're still talking about the wicked. So it would be the leaders of the wicked. When they are thrown over the cliff, then they shall hear my words, for they are pleasant. It seems to be saying that David's words against them and David's prayers to God, that God will judge them, when they come under this judgment, which would be pictured here as being thrown over the cliff, David's words are going to be heard by the leader's followers. And they're going to recognize, hey, you know, what David said about these wicked people is true. Or, as it says here, it's pleasant. I think that is a good possibility of what the verse is saying. But again, the Hebrew is difficult and it gets translated different ways. Verse 7, as when one plows and breaks up the earth, so shall our bones be scattered at the mouth of Sheol. Now again, this is connected with verse 6. It's the idea of the rulers have come under the judgment of God, and this is the reaction of their followers. And so it's the idea they've been thrown over the cliff, and their bones have just been out there, and they've been buried under the topsoil. But then here comes a farmer, and he's plowing up the ground. And as he plows up the ground, here come up those bones, those bleached bones that are scattered at the mouth of Sheol. Sheol is the Hebrew word for the place of the dead. It can refer to the place where the soul goes at death, or the place where the body goes at death, which of course is the grave. Here it's probably referring to the grave. And so the idea that it's getting across, David is saying that the wicked men's end is what he just described. Their position looked so secure, but God has the last word. Just go look at them now. Those bleached bones out there, plowed up by the farmer. That's the end, physically, obviously not spiritually, but physically, of these wicked people. Then, number 4, we have David's prayer for deliverance. Verse 8, but my eyes are toward you, O God, my Lord. In the midst of his trials, he's looking upward. He's looking toward God. It's like the author of Hebrews in Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 talks about us running the race and so on, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And that's what he's doing here in the midst of his trials. He's looking unto Jesus, as it were. In you I seek refuge. Leave me not defenseless. So again, it's his trust is in the Lord, in the Lord he seeks refuge. Leave me not defenseless. In the ESV, it's defenseless. Again, this is one of those places where you're going to find some real variation in the different translations. The NIV says, give me over to death. The NET Bible, which is a fairly recent translation, kind of unique and a good translation, it's all internet-driven, if you're not familiar with the NET Bible, done by people from Dallas Seminary. They put, expose me to danger. Or the King James Version, leave my soul desolate. So it's the idea, in you I seek refuge, leave me not defenseless, don't leave my soul desolate. Don't expose me to danger. In other words, God, you take care of me. Verse 9, keep me from the trap that they have laid for me. So again, it's the enemies of David. They've laid these traps trying to trick him and so on. And it's hard to keep out of the traps when they are camouflaged and so on. But again, God sees them. And so God can keep his people out of them. God can keep us and does keep us from harm. When we get to heaven, we'll discover all kinds of times when we would have been harmed were it not for God keeping us out of harm's way. And that's what David is expressing. Then verse 10, let the wicked fall into their own nets while I pass by safely. Again, it's the idea, the evil things that they have planned for others, may it come back on them. Now for every one of God's children, this eventually will be what happens, because we're going to go to heaven. We're going to be eternally safe with the Lord, but the wicked are going to be in damnation. The damnation of their own making in the sense that they didn't repent and go God's way. Well, that brings us to the next psalm, Psalm 142, on the next page. And again, this psalm has a superscription for Psalm 142. A maskil of David when he was in the cave, a prayer. It's been quite a while since we've had a psalm that was called a maskil. Maskil is a Hebrew word, and it has the idea of teaching and instruction. So a psalm that's called a maskil is a psalm for the purpose of teaching and instructing. Some psalms really are directed to the emotions. Other psalms are directed to the mind and to the thinking and to the teaching. And this is one of them. It's written by David when he was in the cave. That could be the cave of Adullam. 1 Samuel 22 verse 1 talks about when Saul was pursuing David. David went into this cave of Adullam and was protected there. Later, he went into another cave, also when he was being pursued by Saul. It was in a cave at a place called En-Gedi, which is by the Dead Sea. And when you were with Linda, I think you went to En-Gedi. Oh, great place. And that's in 1 Samuel 24, verses 1 to 3. So in one of these caves, in the experience of one of those times in the cave, David wrote this psalm. And he begins the psalm by crying out to the Lord. He's in this predicament. He's being pursued by Saul. And so in verse 1, with my voice I cry out to the Lord, to his God, who is Yahweh. Because you have Lord there in all capital letters. The personal name for God. Personal name for God refers to the fact that he is the self-existing one. Remember, Moses asked God, well, who shall I say you are, who sent me? And he gives his personal name, Yahweh, which has to do with I am, for I am, is the idea of self-existing. So that means he is the one alone who can help. And he's the one that David cries out to. And he cries out with his voice. And as he cries out with his voice to the Lord, I plead for mercy to the Lord. So notice the emphasis on the personal pronouns in verse 1. I cry, I plead. Verse 2, I pour, I tell. There are many times in our prayers where it is proper to make it a very group thing. In the Lord's Prayer, the Lord, our Father who art in heaven. But when you're in trouble, there is nothing like crying out to God personally. Like, God, I'm in this difficulty. I need this help. And so he pleads for mercy to the Lord. I pour out my complaint before him. I tell my trouble before him. Reminds me of the important verses in the New Testament talking to us about praying when we have a burden on our heart. Philippians 4, 6 and 7. Don't worry about anything, but in everything, come to God in prayer and thanksgiving. Make your requests be made known unto God, and the peace of God, which passes all understanding, shall keep your heart and mind. Philippians 4, 6 and 7. And then 1 Peter 5, 7, cast all your care upon the Lord because he cares for us. And that's what David is doing here. He's pouring out his anxiety, his complaint, his trouble before the Lord. Then in verses 3 and 4, we have David's collapse. Verse 3, when my spirit faints within me, you know my way. In the path where I walk, they have hidden a trap for me. Now, when his spirit faints within me, that's the idea of fear, discouragement, depression, all that kind of thing causing these emotions inside of us would be what he's describing as my spirit faints within me. But as he gets discouraged and as he gets scared, he tells the Lord, but Lord, I know, you know my way. God sees everything perfectly. So when we're discouraged and we're depressed and we're fearful and so on, and we cry to him, we can take comfort and encouragement from knowing that he sees, he knows. In the path where I walk, they've hidden a hidden trap for me. Again, this idea keeps popping up that David just felt like there were all these booby traps around for him. But again, David knows that the Lord knows where they are. Nothing is a surprise to him. And so in verse 4, look to the right and see. There is none who takes notice of me. It's kind of ironic for David to say that, because at the beginning of his career, when he killed Goliath, you remember that the whole nation noticed him. He was a hero. He was a celebrity. He was a star. But now he's being chased by Saul, and he feels that there is none who takes notice of me. No refuge remains to me. No one cares for my soul. He feels like no one cares whether he lives or dies. That's a terrible feeling. Told you about that one phone call. I was on another phone call last week with someone who said that exact same thing. There's no soul on this earth who cares whether I live or die. That wasn't true, because it's a person I know, and I care for him, and I know others do, but he was that discouraged, where he felt like no one cares for my soul. And it would probably amaze us to know all the people that we rub shoulders with as we go into stores and at work or wherever, that if they were honest, would feel that way. And of course, God wants to use us to encourage them that that is not true. Well, then in verse 5, we have C, David's confidence. He says, I cry to you, O Lord. I say, you are my refuge, my portion in the land of the living. He doesn't see anyone else around who cares, doesn't care whether he lives or dies, but at least he knows the Lord does. And so he says, I cry to you, you are my refuge, because in the previous verse he said, no refuge remains for me, that is, among people here on earth. But he knows he has a refuge with the Lord. My portion in the land of the living. Evidently, when David was in this terrible situation of having to run from Saul, it appeared to him that everything that belonged to him, any inheritance that was coming to him and so on, it was all gone. He didn't have any of it anymore. But he's able to say, but Lord, even if I don't have any of these earthly things, yet I have you. You're my portion. You know, in our day, with retirement funds losing their value and all of that kind of thing, it's easy to feel, wow, everything, I'm losing everything. But for the Christian, that's never true, because the Lord is my portion. So in verse 6, attend to my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors. That would be Saul and his men, for they are too strong for me. They far outnumber David. Verse 7, bring me out of prison. That would be the cave, the place where he's confined. Bring me out of prison with no harm from my enemies that are right now gathered around the mouth of the cave. Bring victory, in other words, to all of this. Why? That I may give thanks to your name. Verse 7, the righteous will surround me, for you will deal bountifully with me. David says the situation's going to change. I'm surrounded by the evil, by the wicked, but God, you're working through this, and eventually I will be surrounded by the righteous because you deal bountifully with me. That is true for all of us when you look at eternity. All the problems down here, surrounding us and so on, but there's coming a day when the righteous will surround us, and God, it will be so obvious, is dealing bountifully with us. He's dealing bountifully with us now, but sometimes it's not so obvious and we lose sight of it. But then it will be obvious. Well, desperate times produce desperate prayers, and troubles cause us to cry out to the Lord, and there's no one that can help but the Lord. And so prayer is so important for us in those times, like it was for David. Well, that's a good stopping point since it's 8 o'clock, and we will pick up 2 weeks from tonight with Psalm 143. As I said at the beginning, Lord willing, Terry and I next week will be on vacation in Yosemite, and Bob Morris will teach from Isaiah on Wednesday night. I'll turn off the recording, and we'll have any prayer requests.